Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking with Kristen Caskey. Welcome, Kristen, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. It's my turn to say something.
Oh, yeah, right. Hello out there. Let me just read a short bio. You're currently an associate professor at VCU's Department of Fashion and Design and Merchandising. You're a fashion designer and sculptor who was born in Washington, D.C. and educated at Cornell College, Parsons, and Cranbrook. She's worked in design, education, and exhibitions in New York, Kansas, and China, which we'll come back to, just to name a few. Her work has been shown in the Mid-Atlantic and Midwest and in Amsterdam. Kristen's work is shown as sculpture and yet comes almost entirely from the fiber medium, which I thought was interesting. Basically, just sort of blurring the boundaries between fashion, fiber, and performance. So as we were talking about earlier before, you were talking about, you know, starting out as an artist and moving into design and then sort of coming full circle. So let's just sort of talk a little bit about that journey for you.
Well, going to a small college, Cornell College is the little school in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's a lovely little place, but, you know, I found something there. I was going pre-med, actually, when I started in pre-engineering.
Really?
So I was
really?
Sort of a biology honor student.
So wait a minute. So pre-engineering, then pre-med?
Yeah.
Okay.
It changed. And then once I figured out chemistry was not my thing, I decided to be an artist.
Right.
Which was somewhere I'd been a lot as a kid. But I had real non-traditional education growing up. I went to a free school. So I was part of this really 70s movement in Minneapolis.
What's a free school?
It was the freest, freakiest hippie school.
Sort of like Montessori on steroids?
More. This was 1972, and Minneapolis was really progressive. It's probably one of the most progressive cities in the country. And they had six progressive schools, and the free school was the craziest.
Okay.
There were 120 kids, kindergarten and 12th grade. And we'd get on school buses and drive to Mexico or go to California and pick grapes. You know,
really?
We did these kinds of things. But coming from that, I didn't know kind of the regular trajectory of going to college
or
how you pick what you're going to be. So I became really involved after the sciences. I became really involved in the arts again as an undergrad and was just in a lovely little place where I could be the crazy, punky, freaky girl who made the costumes. And finally I had a teacher who said, "You need to be a fashion designer." And I'm like, "Huh? You mean like Vogue?" And he's like, "Yeah, like Vogue." I'm like, "Really?" And he said, "You need to look at Parsons School of Design." And this was foreign to me. I didn't realize that these magazines, I could do this thing, possibly. So I applied to Parsons and got in and went there, you know, took a train out there, and there I was in New York. and that was a whole different thing because I was
not such a big deal. I mean, you grew up in D.C.
I grew up in D.C., so. But I wasn't very urban. I grew up a little outside of D.C.
Okay.
And I would say that my parents were a little scared of the city during the 60s and 70s. So I wasn't super urban, although I'd lived in Minneapolis. But I wasn't scared of New York.
Right.
But the fashion industry and the fashion education scene at Parsons in New York is really 7th Avenue. It's really glamour, lifestyle, money, competitive.
Yeah.
And I did fine because I was driven. I was an older student. I was paying for it myself. And I actually did so well that I was their student designer of the year. So they
really?
Were helping me to launch myself into being a designer for a 7th Avenue kind of company, like an Anne Klein or something. And the design industry is really different from the fine arts system. And I
think design, help me out here. I'll fess up to my ignorance. When you're talking about design, you're talking about design, clothing design, furniture design. What are you?
Graphic design.
What were you focused on?
I was focused on fashion design, but when you think about any of the design industries, I think looking back now as a design educator, when you think about interior design, graphic design, fashion design, product design, we think really differently from fine arts because we have to have a tangible item that sits, walks, goes in the closet, you know, gets washed, you wear it again, and you might wear it for 20 years.
Right.
Same with a chair. You got to sit in it, move it, you want to keep it.
Right.
It's really different than a fine arts product, even though we may conceptualize in a similar way.
It's almost part of that engineering thinking.
We have to be we have to be pragmatic at some level, but we still have to have that inventiveness for people to be interested. So I worked in that industry for 6 years, and I was a designer for Perry Ellis, for Urban Outfitters, Anthropologie, a company called Arlequin.
What did you design for Urban Outfitters?
Clothing. They're Anthropologie, so, yeah. Free People, and Ecote lines of clothing.
Okay.
In the late 80s.
Uh-huh.
And I worked all over the world. I've worked in Hong Kong, India, Portugal, Turkey, Macau, a lot of time in France, China.
Why all over the world?
Because that's where you make clothes.
What do you mean?
That's where the factories are.
Ah, okay.
So you
okay,
design,
that's where you
when
literally
you're a
make
designer,
them.
You actually have to go
uh-huh.
and make sure that things are okay.
Okay.
You have to go through the bazaar markets in India and find the fabric because
really?
The factory that ordered the fabric screwed up.
Right. Okay.
And you have to go find buttons, and you have to go on fabric appointments, and you have to fit, and you're doing like four seasons at a time. So there's all this business and all this problem solving.
So how long were you overseas? I mean, would you
three
go
weeks
somewhere?
At a time. I would
yeah,
go
really? Yeah.
Four times a year, 3 weeks at a time, and I'd usually hop Europe, India, Hong Kong, China, and
uh-huh.
then back with a whole bunch of samples for the line opening
Did you
in
like
New York.
It?
I loved it.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Seeing
yeah.
the world, you know, landing
yeah, yeah.
the first time in India. But
yeah.
it changed my mind about who I should be in the world eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Going to India 14 times.
Right.
You know, you started to say, why am I working for this corporation where
mm-hmm.
my boss is living in a $4 million house
mm-hmm.
and I'm telling people a dress should be 10 cents cheaper?
Right.
I didn't want to be doing that anymore after a certain point. It didn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although I'd gained a lot of money, a
right.
lot of
success.
Experience, success, you know, job offers, but it didn't feel right. And I started looking kind of internally saying, who do I need to be? You know, who's this person that I used to be in high school, this really
right.
kind of progressive person that was interested in spirituality and
mm-hmm.
community?
Mm-hmm.
And that person was missing in an industry like fashion
mm-hmm.
at the level I was in because
mm-hmm.
it was 65 hours a week. And
sounds like the devil in Prada.
It really can be like that.
Yeah.
And I worked at great companies, but it was too
no,
much.
No, but I mean, that sort of, that, have you ever seen that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the young assistant who gets drawn into all of that glamour and everything and then finally says, wait a minute, this isn't who I am.
Right, wait a minute, what's going
yeah,
on? Yeah,
going
do
on
I want
here.
To keep going on this path?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the amazing things. I'm reading a book about people who win the MacArthur Award.
Right.
And they talk about that kind of, and I've talked about this with people. I see that as a certain form of personal courage of you know, because you got everything going for you.
Right.
And I've talked to other artists who were in other industries where it was really going for them. And then something inside said, no, I got to talk about
stop.
That a little bit. What is that?
I think it was a really good basis in reality as a
mm-hmm.
teenager, doing
mm-hmm.
some really bad things and saving myself.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of saved myself from bad situations a
mm-hmm.
number of times,
right.
bad decisions that you make as a
mm-hmm.
teenager. And I think I had a really, really strong relationship with books my whole life. Growing
mm-hmm.
up, mm-hmm. I was reading.
Right.
My father and mother are big readers, and they would push things on me that I wasn't ready for. So I had this whole constructed idea of a world, and then this idealistic idea of a world,
mm-hmm.
and then these weird ideas about religion and what that should be, because I was reading Bertrand Russell and
mm-hmm.
things that weren't what you might usually give a 13-year-old. So I was kind of going back to those things, which were my
right.
roots, that sort of
right.
time of adolescence when you're so hopeful and yet so troubled. And
mm-hmm.
it's like that hopefulness came back in me and that trouble of this doesn't feel right. So
mm-hmm.
I started doing weird things like trying to meditate or
right.
I was biking a lot, which was great. And that helped me because the people I was hanging out with were really
so it was outgoing. It was a difficult transition.
It was a hard transition. And my family said, you can't leave.
Yeah.
You're making more money than
yeah.
anyone in our family's
right.
ever made. How
right.
can you leave?
Right.
You're 29, you know?
Right.
You need to go marry a doctor
right.
and, like,
right.
just keep going. And
or an artist and watch
an
him
artist,
have a nice
right.
life.
Right. right. Like, what's going on? But I made a decision, and actually the company I was at, Urban Outfitters, was wonderful. They gave me a year to figure it out.
Really?
Because I was their designer.
Mm-hmm.
I had an assistant, and we had production people and a design director. But they really respected my who I'd been there in that 3.5 years. And
so you talked to them about this?
I said
you were going
I was thinking
through?
About going to grad school, and they really let me take the time to decide and said, you know, if you decide you don't want to do it, you can come back.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I consulted for them for a while, so I give great credit to the Megan
right.
DeCane, who were the owners really of that company, for
right.
their really generous spirit of letting me explore who I might need to be.
Right.
So I started taking printmaking classes again
uh-huh.
in Philadelphia, which was something I'd done as an undergrad. So I started looking at schools in printmaking because that was sort of the last art thing I really was close to. And I didn't
right.
even realize I could tie clothes into – I didn't look at fibers. You know, I don't
right.
know why. I just didn't know. It's like
uh-huh.
I was so busy doing other things. I didn't know artists could be fiber artists. And
okay, okay.
So I went into print media at Cranbrook, but at that school, the important thing is your fit.
So it was sort of a you were still sort of in graphics?
I was still in a sort of graphic arts.
All right,
yeah.
But you were now doing printmaking.
Printmaking.
So
good
instead
old fashioned.
Instead of design tied to a corporate kind of environment.
Right.
Okay, so you were moving slowly.
Well,
not really slowly, but
pretty quick. But
pretty quick, yeah.
You know, I still use that vocabulary sewing because that was such a second nature to me. Mm-hmm. And at Cranbrook, it was a really conceptual program, and I think installation art was really important. I was there in 92 through 94.
Mm-hmm.
So you could think outside of your media.
Right.
So I used a needle and thread a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought about that idea of the multiple and repetition, and that made sense with my fashion background, this production of meaning or volume that we look at in print media. And Steve Murakishi was my mentor there, and he was just, you know, incredible for me, really a strong relationship.
Who's Steve Murakishi? Should know, but I don't.
Well, he was the head of print media at Cranbrook for 18, 20 years.
Okay, so well-known by people.
Well-known by printmaker people, yeah. Just a very close relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was also a place where you didn't have to be a TA. You didn't have to get a job. You just lived in the weird dorms in this estate.
Uh-huh.
And you'd walk across the street to your studio. It was really weird. And then all those kids
Sounds
who went
really
there.
Sounds really nice, actually.
Well, it was graduate school only. And then there were these middle schools and lower schools where, like, the richest people in Detroit go.
Really?
So these kids would be driving, like, Porsches. And then there'd be these art students, you know, driving
Slogging
these old
across
beaters.
The street. Right.
So
exactly.
it was really, like, a lovely, idyllic place to spend 2 years.
Yeah.
But after that, I really thought, okay, I'm going to move to Portland. I'm going to flip burgers. I'm going to be an artist.
Right.
I'm going to show as a contemporary artist. I'm going to get gallery shows. I don't care if I don't make money. I'm just going to be happy. And
stop. I don't care if I'm going to make money. I'm just going to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well,
that seems to be a very big theme here.
Still really important for me. I could give up what I'm doing if I decide that it's not making me happy.
Right.
And it gets harder, as you know, as you get older.
Right.
I have a 5-year-old, you know, you have a life, and we don't have a really high-maintenance lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to me to be happy in the world and to feel like what I'm doing is sensible and makes sense. And I found that in fashion design because you were making garments that people needed and they wanted, and I always felt that that was a useful way for me to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
As I moved more towards contemporary art making and installation making, I still felt that there was a way there that I was trying to bring an experience or an opening space to people, and that was always an attempt in my work until I think recently, was to open some kind of door of perception or some way of seeing the world from a different view that might re-empower a person to feel
So the audience is important to you?
The audience has always been important to me.
It has been. Okay.
It has been. And at times, you know, as a young artist, you might be fumbling and trying to make the audience more involved than they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then I eventually liked this idea of creating spaces or places where people would be able to find a breath or find a place for themselves again.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that comes from, you maybe as I've aged, looking at practices like yoga or more Eastern practices or just practices of gardening and quietness, things that we don't have a lot of in contemporary life, things that we're losing, this idea of contemplation. So I think that contemplation is still important to me, but what's happened increasingly is the work I've made has gone from being large scale, difficult to store, and not sustainable in terms of reuse.
Mm-hmm.
So although I made a number of things out of textiles that I've been able to give away or sell,
I
still have a number of very large objects, textile mostly, that I don't really want to end up throwing in a dumpster. So I'm trying to figure out how to repurpose those.
Uh-huh.
And as I've gone forward...
Repurpose them? What do you mean?
Well, remake them or recycle them.
Yeah, do something with them again.
Do something again. And and not save them for this idea that I need an archive and I'm going to have a retrospective. It's just not where I'm at, you know. I don't think I need that validation. But as I've aged, and also as I've had a little kid, I had a kid at 40. And I'm 46 now, so, boy, I don't want to bring much more stuff into the world.
Right.
I mean, having a kid just... Even if you don't buy your kid stuff, stuff comes. And the kid finds stuff. And even if you don't let people give you stuff, it just changes what I think is important to
you. Been to McDonald's lately?
We don't at all. She thinks it's called Old McDonald's Farm. She just sings a song. She doesn't even know what it is.
As I swore I would never go. Right. But I got suckered in.
Oh, yeah. It'll, you know what happens. You're on the road. You need some French fries. It's the only place.
Yeah,
no,
I know.
Go there. But we've become increasingly sustainable in our food lifestyle and trying to be less impactful in our choices that we make as consumers for a number of years. And so as an artist, boy, I just really started questioning making big stuff. So when I had a child, I started making a little line of clothing, housewares, and accessories called Loopy Lou, which is primarily wool felt, with the idea that any profit would go to Lulu or to her education.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I needed to make things, because I am a thing maker.
Right, right.
And so I thought, okay, I'll design a great little line, these like little felt jackets and, you know, ornaments, bracelets, holiday stockings, things that I enjoy making, that I love the color, I love the textile, I can change the patterns up, and they're handwork, they're hand sewn, a lot of them. So they're easy for me to produce in a way that, that just flows as part of
a day.
So
it's on the web, right?
It's on the web, okay, loopylu.com.
How do you spell it?
L-U-P-I-L-U.
Okay.
So that's one thing that I do, and I'm still doing that. And then I started to add more practice
then,
into it.
But those are things for kids, is that what you said?
Well, kids' coats. I also make skirts for some clients, adult clients.
Uh-huh.
And then I make like holiday things, holiday stockings and ornaments and things that just make me happy.
Right. And how does that work for you?
It works really well.
Really?
Yeah, because it's easy to make in terms of the production and the scale. It's a domestically produced wool felt, so it's a domestic production. I'm not importing anything.
Right.
It comes from Pennsylvania. The colors are really rich. And it's a really lovely material to work with. Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of happy making practice. And it's a design practice too. I can add a new thing to my line. I get lots of responses from people about it.
Really?
So it's a very positive thing. It's small, but it works for me.
Right, yeah, great.
It doesn't need to be my living because I'm a professor, so.
Okay.
But, you know, my outside research, I've been working with digital printing now on textiles at VCU, and so I've started to use that in my gallery-type work now.
Okay, so we've gone from you being a high-paid designer traveling all over the world to you being a printmaker, right?
Yep.
To you getting into using materials as a or cloth as a medium for installation kinds of work.
Yeah.
Is there any installation work in there we should be talking about?
At this point, I don't really think so. I've made some nice pieces with video components, but they still always were either wearable, dealing with clothing, dealing with textile pattern and textile history. And there's nothing going on with me right now in really an installation scene.
Okay.
Like I have a show up.
So now you're getting into, I'm sorry, you said.
Digital fabric printing.
Like, fabric printing?
Yeah.
Really?
I have a.
Talk about that.
We have a Japanese machine that'll print fabric up to 60 inches wide.
Of course
at
it's
VCU.
Japanese.
Of course it is. It's the best.
I don't know why that makes sense, but it just seems to make sense.
They're always at the
front. I guess because Japanese, you know, you associate with silk, and silk being just this, you know, wonderful, wonderful material.
Well, I think they're at the front in a lot of digital technology. And
So how do you make... I'm sorry.
Well, you
digital
take a,
material?
You take a bolt of fabric that's been prepared for printing, and instead of screen printing on it or hand painting on it, you run it through basically a giant inkjet printer.
Okay.
It's a giant inkjet printer just for fabric, and they're being used commercially a lot now in fabric production. So we're able to make rapid prototypes for students at VCU, which is really great. And as an artist, I really liked working with that because it brings printmaking back into it.
So you design the design.
Exactly.
Okay.
The pattern
Or the pattern or whatever. And so is the pattern sort of like when you go to like a hardware store and just get sort of a base paint and they add color to it? Or is the fabric can be many different colors?
Oh, many different colors.
Really?
It can be millions of colors. You can take digital photographs. You can make
But I mean,
crazy
the fabric
images.
That you actually feed in this machine.
Oh,
is
the
that,
fabric
is that,
you feed into it is, you could order a fabric that had some color woven into it.
Right.
And then have it coated, but usually it's a white.
It is a white. Okay.
Ground,
okay,
right?
I got you. Okay.
But you can print any
okay.
color on it.
All right.
And multiple colors, because you can print in true color.
So this is the difference between printing or dyeing individual threads or individual woven things and then weaving together
right.
into something that has a pattern or...
Well, this is throwing
this
the
is,
throwing the print on a fabric. So if you have printed sheets or printed curtains, they usually do that with what's called a rotary screen or a screen print or a block print. This is a process that's just a faster process because it's digital. And they've made the equipment so good now that you can make a very high-end product by having like thousands of dots per inch.
Right.
So you can have a
and
very
And the material absorbs it.
We can it can absorb it mostly. You have to finish it by steaming it, but you get a very fine end product, like a commercial textile that you'd buy in a store.
Okay.
So I've been interested in this technology for my own work and creating patterns for my own life, like the series of jumpsuits I made. I made a jumpsuit for doing things with Lulu, where she created drawings, and I made those drawings into
Lulu
a fabric
Lulu being
repeat.
Your daughter.
That's my daughter.
Okay.
And then I created a jumpsuit for her and for myself where we had so many pockets that we could put all this crap that she picks up and the acorns and the treasures and the broken bird's eggs. So we both had enough pockets that we could have everything we needed with us for an outing. And I actually have been wearing those quite a bit in the summer for traveling.
What are they made out of?
They're cotton.
They're cotton?
Cotton twill that I've printed and then set snaps on and constructed.
Okay.
And then I made jumpsuits for other things that are close to my life, like gardening. Animal husbandry. We have a lot of pets, and they always need something. So this feeling that I was sort of the sergeant of the poodle, I had to deal with being the alpha dog. So I made a sort of military jumpsuit for my pets. I'm always telling them to go lay down, you know, or stop it.
Hang on. Let me put on my jumpsuit here. Lay down.
I'm going to go deal with the animals.
How many animals do you have?
Two dogs, two cats.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean,
so it's not
horrible.
Like a farm.
It's not a farm.
All right. Yeah.
Well, we're thinking chickens, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, chickens. I don't know about chickens. But anyway.
But we're, I guess feel like where my work comes from now, like what I have currently at the show in Quirk or month of September, October.
Quirk, which is on Broad Street.
On Broad Street.
Right.
That work is design-based. It's also based just on me. But the other project I'm doing now that has been kind of brings a lot of my lifestyle interest together, and also this idea of divesting myself of things I don't need, whether they be careers or products. I'm wearing every piece of clothing I own before I wear something twice.
Is this the one where you're taking pictures?
I'm taking a picture every day.
Okay, so you're taking a picture of yourself every day.
Every morning.
For the next 20 years. No, for how
long?
Well,
I think it's going to go through March. I did a spreadsheet with Excel and figured that based on shirts, sweaters, fitted jackets, and dresses, which could be considered tops, I could go 306 days without repeating one. And I have gone 4.5 months now without repeating a top. Now, I did have to repeat some pants and skirts.
How does that jibe with your whole thing of not having excess or having
a
simple lifestyle?
Well, I'm giving away or selling thrift store style 2/3 of what I own in the clothing realm. After I wear them, I do a poll. I have a website called Aesthetic to Ascetic at blogspot.com.
Right.
And people vote on the look of the day, like it, don't like it. I have regular followers.
People
can post comments.
Oh, say it again.
Aesthetic to Ascetic at blogspot.com. God. Or Aesthetic to Ascetic.blogspot.com.
Do you know how to spell any of those words?
Yeah, Aesthetic.
Yeah.
Two.
The letter two?
A-S-C-E.
The number two?
T-O. Just T-O. And then aesthetic.blogspot.com.
Okay.
But you could Google aesthetic to ascetic and it would come up.
I just wouldn't know how to spell ascetic.
A-S-C-E-T-I-C. But it's been great because I've never looked at myself objectively, like being a fashion person, I've just been hauling this stuff around.
Right.
I mean, really a lot of stuff. Unbelievable. Right. And putting it in plastic bags, sticking it in the attic. And now I'm looking at an image of myself every day, and I finally objectively see who I am. I never did that before.
Right.
So it's really easy to take something and put it aside if it just, you're like, you know, the sentimental value is gone. I've looked at it objectively. I have seen it in a different way.
Right.
I don't need it. I'm going to give it to diversity. Someone else can use it.
Right.
And this makes me really think about ever bringing anything back into my house. I'm not buying any clothes for this year either, so that's part of it.
Why is that? What's driving that?
Just way over consumption.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't need all the stuff we're trying to be sold. And
didn't you just renovated your house, or did you buy a house?
We built a house.
You built a house.
We built a house from scratch.
Okay. And it's covered in?
It's covered in copper. It's very pretty. It's really purple right now.
Yeah. I was going to say, it does tend to change color.
Well, it's one of those, another decision, we put geothermal in. We put really high our value finish. And we didn't do a lot of interior, this, that, and the other thing. We didn't do a real glamorous, shiny, you know, sharp kind of house. It's a real wood kind of thing.
For people who don't know what geothermal is a way by which you can use tubing running under the ground to maintain the temperature of the liquid inside the tubing at about 55 degrees. So in the summertime, that can be used as air conditioning. In the wintertime, it can be used partly as heating. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the sort of the quickest definition I can think of.
Yeah, and it gives you a real difference in the nature of your how much your heat or cooling runs.
Yeah, I was going to say real difference in the nature of
your
heating
difference
bill.
In the bill. Yeah, oh, yeah, right. Big difference from our smaller house in Churchill to this house.
Yeah.
And it's not a huge house. It's by today's standards, it's a small house.
How big is it?
About 2,300
square feet.
Yeah,
is
so
it two-story?
It's actually kind of three-story plus three-story? A usable attic that's sleeping area.
All right.
But we decided just, I think, too, when we were thinking about moving, that we should build something that made sense. We had an architect friend, Camden Whitehead, who's at VCU, designed it for us, and we worked with a great crew of guys. Mm-hmm. Six people built it, so it really was not, it was in a way built locally, like it has an authenticity of place and the site and everything.
Well, we're almost running out of time. Talk about teaching, if you could.
Teaching, well, what a great job. Yeah. I mean, if you can get it, you know, it's a really great job. Even when you start getting sick of it, what I find for me, obviously change has been a feature in my life. I will drop things and change and mutate. And when I start feeling like I'm getting molasses, which is 11 years now, I pick something new up and work on that. So it's been digital printing. But I'm also working on going forward with a research project where we've been making, students have been making prints and then sleepwear styles for kids in pediatric oncology, like adaptive clothing. So I'm going to follow this research project up, I'm hoping, for the next 2 to 3 years with some more pragmatic ways of looking at maybe doing some studies about clothing and the impact of adaptive clothing in hospital stays. And pediatric oncology patients can be there for 8 or 9 months.
Right.